No, I'm serious. I think back to the first tour, and I think back to, well, four boys who were probably about as unhealthy looking and appearing as any I'd ever seen, up close, like we are in a room now, as we were in another hotel at that time, on a whirlwind tour. I mean a whirlwind tour of life, not that it was the American tour, but the pace and everything, and how really confusing life must have been then, and how it was impossible to find oneself. And through these last few years, I see John has found himself, and he is an individual, and has found his own individual freedom. And I'm sure you've had a great deal to do with that. But it's been revealing to me. I'm thinking of the hotel room that I was in over on Park Avenue with 30 or 40,000 kids day and night out in the street, just waiting, and watching him sit in a chair and have meals brought in. He couldn't go out or anything, dare. It was a life I looked at and watched from an observer and said, no way would I want this to happen to me. Just, it's a terrible experience. It's just frightening, but in his case, he found, you know, himself too as an individual. But those days, to think about that in one moment of my life and then relate it to today, message, communicate, aside from sound, but to know within yourself now totally, as John can, to know what he did do and his contribution and what he's going to keep doing as an individual and what he believes in without forces, just within himself, is just, that's what I found out today.
That's beautiful. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Well, I was just going to comment on the fact that I think one has oneself in the beginning, and it's a constant process of society and parents and family trying to make you to lose yourself, you know, and like, don't cry, you know, don't show any emotion, that kind of jazz. And that goes on all your life. I remember, I think at 16, I still had myself. From 16 to 28 or 9, that's when it got lost. The struggle to mature, to be a man, to take responsibility, whatever the jazz was. And although we were in a cocoon of, super life, you know, in those hotels and the tour and things like that, we still had to go through the basic maturing that any teenager goes through, whether it's alone with or without drugs somewhere in a room somewhere, or alone in a big office building where they're working the scene out. And that probably 30 is about the age you should be just about waking up and realizing that you know, you're in control of yourself, and that the outside influences, you've got to sort of translate what was going on in your life and work out which was for the good and which was for the bad, and sort of shake off any of the old stuff that had hung around on you, which is what I did in a way. And of course Yoko really woke me up to myself, you know. I mean, she didn't fall in love with the Beatles, she didn't fall in love with my fame. She fell in love with me for myself, and through that brought out the best in me by encouraging me in my artwork, in my films, in my writing, which are all things I did like almost like a hobby. And
I must have been a cool calculator who used the situation and married John for, you know, his fame, etc., you know. I mean, on the contrary, you see, as a cool calculator, I was coolly thinking, isn't this going to be derogatory? Because I was avoiding people with big names because those big names would overshadow mine, you know. And then I met John, and I sort of somehow fell in love, and I forgot that cool conversation, you know. But many people come to me and say, well, look, you know, you being in a powerful position, etc. But, I mean, you know, I have this sort of unique situation that other women wouldn't go through. For instance, we go to a restaurant, and I remember when we went to this one Italian restaurant, and the waiter was trying to serve me first, and the manager quickly came to this waiter and just sort of whispered in his ear, but I could hear it say, go to John first, you know. It's a very unique situation, you know. But, and then also, this I think is not a very unique situation, but the other night, you know, we were working on this film together for about 8 hours, you know. from 10 o'clock at night to 6 in the morning or something. And during that 8 hours, we were working with this engineer, a very good engineer and everything. And John and I working equally on this film, right? And through that 8 hours, never once this engineer addressed me. You know, it was, I would, you know, instruct him, and John would instruct him. Whenever he does anything, or whenever John instructs him, he responds to it. Says, "Yes, John. Is this all right, John?" etc. He never even once said Yoko. Now, the thing is, you know how these female libs are trying to prove themselves so desperately that they don't even want to, you know, repair stockings or whatever, even if they
sew
can sew, you know,
on,
sew a button or whatever. Now, I was sewing a button on something then, you know, while I was doing the recording, you know. And I don't have that thing about, well, we have to frantically prove ourselves, so I'm not going to do what I can do, which is to sew a button, right? And I was doing that. And then so John's observation is that maybe because I was doing those things that this engineer thought that I was just a real female wife that was just sitting there.
Well, the funny thing about it was, this was going on, and I noticed it once or twice, and I thought, oh, well, I must be hearing things. Because only when a woman's there with you pointing out the what's it called, the prejudice, I suppose it's like being black, you know, until you're black or a woman, only some
you
one of them
know.
Can tell you what it's like.
You don't even know.
And then she said it, I never would notice it, right? And then all of us, there was the cameraman, we were all there, we were mixing the sound and everything. Then Yoko told us about it just as we were leaving, and she said, "Did you notice how he ignored me throughout?"
There. Yeah.
And she was... she directed this film and the sound as much as I did. I mean, she knows more about films than I did. It's, you know, she's like, it's 60-40 filmmaking between us. And then the cameraman, we all said, "God almighty."
We
realized
it.
It was going on all the time, just pure prejudice. And of course, the guy's he's probably about 50, and
he's
he doesn't
nice
know
guy,
anybody.
Huh?
He was a very nice guy. He was charming. He's a great engineer. But he just did it without thinking. And then we were all saying, and I thought I would spot it by now because she's been showing me all this continuous prejudice against her that's going on like night and day. I don't know how they survive with it.
Yeah.
And then all the rest of the boys, they were saying, "You're goddamn right. Mm. We never realised. Look at it.
Never even realised.
We'll have to ask our wives, is this going on, right?" Mm. That, you know, they got turned on to ask their wives, "Is this going on with you?" It is going on all the time, the way people just... don't they think women are invisible?
No, look, you see, I'm not saying that just because I'm a female they should address me. I was a filmmaker who was there working, right? And after we finished the work, the engineer came to John and said, "Nice working with you, John. Nice meeting with you, not Mrs. Lennon, but, you know, something like that to me." Complete difference, you know what I mean?
But then
he was working with both of us, you know what I mean?
I used to think he was paranoid, you know. I'd say, "You must be paranoid, you're saying everybody's doing this and ignoring and snubbing you and treating you badly." I'd say, "Not surely not him, you know, if it was somebody that had been working with us a few years or something." I said, "No, they're not like that. They're real aware guys, you know, they really know what's happening. They're not prejudiced." And she just kept pointing out, I'd say, you're paranoid, you know. No wonder.
May I say one thing here?
Yes, I'm
you
sure.
You can only feel this being black.
A nigger, right. I'm saying a woman is a nigger.
She said woman is the nigger of the world in 1967 or 8 in an over interview in England.
And nobody even understood what I meant.
I didn't even know what she meant.
Yeah, but this
time.
Is the only time that you can feel it.
Well,
you can see it immediately, being a woman.
It's so
being
blatant. I couldn't believe how blatant.
Yeah, and the thing that hurt me was that the fact that nobody, none of my friends realized it, and that means that man even would never dreamt that, you know, that he never dreamt that he did anything wrong to me.
No.
The thing I learned from it was, I used to ask myself, if I treated Paul or George or Ringo or any man friend, or expected them to do what I expect from a woman, they'd walk off. If my male friend, if I asked him or said certain things to him, he'd say, "Sod you, I'm leaving." And then I started thinking, "This now, how am I treating her? I was a real chauvinist pig, I realized. How am I treating her? How dare I ask her these things or expect this from her?" If that was Paul, he'd walk out the room. And then I learned to have a friendship with her. It was the first woman I've ever had a relationship with that wasn't a purely chauvinist pig with his lay. I'd never met any woman with any kind of mind before. They'd all been dummies And then I find out, well, she thought all men were dummies, so okay, a lot of people are dummies, right? It's on both sides.
I despise men, you know, before I met John.
But it was incredible, you know.
All men that I met.
It happened every day, every minute, all around us, continuous prejudice, whether it's a waiter or a very well-known star or whoever it was that was going on, or just, it was unbelievable.
It's amazing.
And now I'm getting more aware of it, you know, but it's still something that's... I can hardly believe how blatant it is.
After the 8 hours, John said, it was a beautiful experience. It was a great night, right? I said, all right, 8 hours, full work, and I don't feel great because I was ignored totally for the 8 hours. You know, I wasn't trying to push myself at all. I was just telling him instructions, that whenever I tell him instructions, he doesn't say a word. When John says it, I said, okay, I'll do it, or something, you know, yes, John, etc. So the thing is, we had a totally different 8 hours. He had a beautiful experience. I had a terrible time, but people don't even notice that I had a terrible time. It's a real thing.
Because in the early days, when we were recording together, there was terrible prejudice about the engineers. You know, any young kid or any engineer against her, A, she was a woman. B, she so-called split the Beatles up, and C, what was she doing recording anyway? She should get on with her art, right, or with her knitting. And I'd be over there to back her up. I wasn't overtly pressurizing them, but she would say, look, I want this sound here, and she'd have her own way of saying it. Either she'd use classical terms or whatever, and they would take not a blind bit of notice of her. And we'd be trying to make this record, and I had to keep, every time she gave an instruction, I'd have to repeat it, and then that's the only way they'd hear it. So that went on for a bit, but gradually when they saw how she controlled, she knew exactly what the music was supposed to sound like and what she wanted. Then they began to realize that she knew what she was talking about. Only then did they give her any kind of respect. And now she doesn't need me to over her shoulder to say, no, she means, you know, put more tape on the bass. She might have said chamber, but she meant tape. I'm sorry about that, but, you know, she's learning the words, right? And then, of course, now she can produce herself. She doesn't even need me.
No, I mean, you see, I need an objective, definitely.
Oh, you need
an
objective.
Eye.
I mean, you don't need me to show you. You don't need my translation of your words to the engineers now. They know you can make records.
Yeah,
all right?
Even from the beginning, I think it was mainly that they couldn't hear me because it was coming from a woman, you know. So when that part is, you know, because after the Yoko Ono Plastic Ono album, I think people started to react to me a bit differently. But Fly, I think, is an example that. I don't consider it an album that is a woman's album, you know what I mean? It's just neutral, you know, I mean, it could be a man's, it could be a woman's. And it's a weird thing, you know, when I did the first painting show in New York, you know, this critic from Art News came, he was looking at my show for about an hour, and then he came up to me, and I was the only one who was in the gallery, so he probably thought I was a secretary or something working there, you know, and he said, excuse me, but do you know if Yoko Ono is a man or a woman?
Yeah. It's make a difference to how he looks at the
paper.
The idea of the black bag thing came from a paranoia when some quite talented artist coming to meet her. She was really paranoid. She'd been putting him off for months, but finally he was coming to dinner. So when he got there, she was sitting in a black bag, and the guy couldn't then, you know, sort of one-up her.
Yeah.
So they had a good evening together. And then the concept of
we
did press conference in a black bag in Vienna, and they're saying, is it really you? They don't know what color you are. And we were saying, if all the government jobs and things like that, it sounds crazy, but imagine if all the government jobs or whatever jobs that black people or women are are not allowed in, they should make everybody wear a bag and then audition for the job. Then they take them on their true worth. Or not on how long the hair is, what colour it is, or what sex it is. That's the whole bag idea. You know, the idea behind the bag is total communication with no prejudice, aforesaid, or whatever the wording is.
That's an interesting correlation. In no one really is aware of it each day, but if I do blindfold you and hold your nose, you'll not be able to tell me the food you're eating. The food you love most. Because without the sense of smell, you've missed the taste, so that whatever you're eating, you won't have a taste at all. It won't be anything. As a matter of fact, you could even gag. Or you can do the same thing. You can blindfold each other, and I will hold your nose, or without holding your nose, and I'll give you one glass of ginger ale and a glass of a Coke, and you won't be able to tell me which is which.
Really? Are you sure?
Yes.
Amazing.
Without holding the nose?
You can make some money on it.
I'm going to try that.
Yes.
Because wow. you need the sight and you need the feel and you need to be able to look. When you see that it's brown, you know it's a cola as you're drinking it. Wow. Try it sometime. It's quite interesting. It deals with some of your ideas and art.
It's in the show.
I'm
going to give it up. But in the Syracuse show, there's a very similar thing in one room. Is it the blue room?
The sixth dimensional room.
And it's very something like you were saying. And you have to experience things anew. You know, it could be with your nose covered or blind or whatever. We're not going to say which it is. But things vary like that. Mm. And for people to experience it, there's another part of the show that's called a weight object.
You talked about the weight.
Right, well, where you don't know, things are different than from what you expect.
Just a disorder, so, you know, to make upside
that's very
down.
So you've got to come along and try this sixth sense room.
In fact, we'll
pinch his idea and have cold and ginger ale there for people, too.
Yes, experiment
and
first.
And have a little, experiment.
Because I was going to have food there, you see, and to have people experience it through food, you know. So it'll be good to have.